I thought I would briefly outline what I've said, have to say in my paper, which is incidentally online, just in case I don't make any sense here. My paper really presents a very modest and sensible proposal, I might add, with regard to subsidiarity. But at the outset, let me acknowledge that chances of its ever being implemented are very remote. Now, I start out here with an inherent contradiction concerning the key concept of federalism that is found in the Federalist Papers itself. And this contradiction, I think, carries over into our discourse today, and in particular in, conservative attitudes towards federalism. So let me begin, and then I will turn to how subsidiarity fits into all of this. Let me begin with the Federalist. It presents us with two models or two paradigms of federal arrangements. At two points in the Federalist, Federalist 9 and 39, we are led to believe that the division of powers between the states and national government is constitutionally fixed somehow, and that the states are to retain residuary and inviolable sovereignty. Hamilton puts it in Federalist 9 as follows, and I'm quoting, "The proposed Constitution leaves in there the states' possession certain exclusive and very important portions of sovereign power." Madison in number 39 echoes this by saying, and I quote again, "The proposed government cannot be deemed a national one since its jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated objects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other objects." Now, I call this conception of federalism a divided sovereignty conception, which of course raises any number of questions that we faced historically. When there is a dispute between the two levels or two jurisdictions, who is to settle the dispute? And how and what ways is the dispute to be settled? The who and what? One point, and I think Madison here in 39 is disingenuous. One point, he says, a tribunal to be established under the general government should judge of such disputes impartially, says he, according to the rules of the Constitution. But as many pointed out, Jefferson, Taylor, Calhoun, many at the time pointed out, the court, the national court, is an agency of the national government, and you can hardly expect an agency of the national government to adjudicate disputes impartially. And then he goes on to talk about the rules of the Constitution, but when you think about it, there are no rules in the Constitution for determining or making a determination of these disputes. One, we need only look at McCulloch versus Maryland, one of the major cases in our constitutional history, to see that Marshall didn't find any rules. He had to turn to usages of word. He had to turn to placement of clause in Constitution. He didn't find any rules in the Constitution that would enable to him to answer that particular question. So these are the great difficulties associated with the divided sovereignty conception number one, or model number one. And I might say conservatives, along with many other Americans of various persuasions, are perhaps more inclined than others to think of federalism in terms of this divided sovereignty paradigm. And it is interesting to note that this divided sovereignty paradigm prevailed for a good deal of our history. Contrary to what Brutus and others had contended, Brutus being one of the leading anti-federalists, contrary to what Brutus and anti-other federalists had to say, the court did try to uphold in its own fashion, impartially, this divided sovereignty model. There's the famous child labor case, Hammer versus Dagenhart. Just let me read that to you because it indicates the extent to which the court did accept the divided sovereignty model. In interpreting the Constitution, it must never be forgotten, said the court, that the nation is made up of states to which are entrusted powers of local government. And to them and to the public, the powers not expressly delegated, the word expressly is put in there, expressly delegated to the national government are reserved. And the decision continued that to sustain a statute preventing interstate commerce of goods produced by child labor would, I quote, sanction invasion of the federal power of the control of a matter purely local in character and over which no authority has been delegated to Congress. Now, it was this divided sovereignty view view of federalism that was overturned by the New Deal, and shortly after courts, various decisions are cited here, but Jones, Laughlin, Steele case, for example, seemed to overturn this divided sovereignty notion of federalism. But now we've returned to it in a certain sense. You're probably all familiar with Lopez versus the United States. We find that Rehnquist comes back again with the divided sovereignty notion, and it seems as if a majority backs this notion, at least at the present time, to some extent at least. And Justice Rehnquist, in delivering his decision in that particular case, put his finger on the difficulty associated with the abandonment of the divided sovereignty framework, namely that if you interpret the commerce power so broadly, then the national government has practically control over just about anything, far beyond what the framers ever contemplated. But as I indicated at the outset, this is not the only model, and again we turn to the Federalists for a second model. And I call this second model the political model of federalism. And it's set forth at the very beginning of Federalist number 46, set forth very clearly there. And both the national, let me quote from it, both the national and state governments, Madison points out, are substantially dependent on the great body of the citizens of the United States. They are, he continues, but different agents and trustees of the people, instituted with different powers and designated for different purposes. The adversaries of the Constitution, he contends, have viewed these different governments as mutual rivals and enemies without any common superior. But this view, he insists, is erroneous. These adversaries have lost sight of the people. They must be told, he writes, that the ultimate authority, wherever the derivative may be found, resides in the people alone, and that it will not depend merely upon the comparative ambition or address of the different governments, whether either or which of them will be able to enlarge its sphere of jurisdiction at the expense of the other. Truth no less than decency requires that the event in every case should be supposed to depend on the sentiments and sanction of their common constituents. This would, when you look at common constituents, what does this mean? Well, it means the people, and how are the people, where can you find the will of the common constituents? Lead you straight away to Congress, and at various other places in the Federalist, they accept this. Yes, it really will be Congress which is going to represent the common constituents and will hold the balance of, trying to hold the balance of the line between the state and the national government. Then the Federalist goes on, Madison says, well, the common constituents are likely to side with that government which provides better administration. And then you find Hamilton coming along saying, and Jay as well, saying in note their opinion that the national government will provide better administration. So you have that aspect of the Federalist thrown in, and this stands athwart the other conception of the Federalist as one of a division of sovereignty. Now, taken as a whole, this political conception of federalism here that's given to us in the Federalist is really quite startling, and conservatives have recognized in the past, yes, that there is this conception, vaguely perhaps they've recognized it, because they've said, gee, you know, ever since the 17th Amendment with the direct election of senators, for example, this particular political conception of federalism is more or less broken down because the states really don't have an input into the system. But whether the senators are elected directly or not, the implication of this particular conception of federalism, the implications are enormous because it indicates that federalism is really not a constitutional principle in the ordinary sense of the word. It means that the people themselves are to judge through Congress in one fashion or another which government is to have which power and how the powers are to be distributed between the two levels of government. Now, if this sounds theoretical, what we encountered in the 1930s when Roosevelt came in and had his difficulty with the court was a clash of these two conceptions of federalism. You had the court sticking to the divided sovereignty of federalism until it changed, and you had Roosevelt urging the political conception of federalism. And what's happened here is that the political conception of federalism, I think, by and large, Lopez, to notwithstanding the political conception of federalism now prevails. Now, with having said that much, then how does the subsidiarity principle fit into this? And I think it fits in because at the present time, when Congress is dealing with matters of how power ought to be allocated, it's doing so in a vacuum. I know of no principles by which they operate. And it is here that it would seem to me that we, at least as conservatives, might urge upon our congressmen to look at the matter from the angle of the principle of subsidiarity. That there is no morality with regard. There is no constitutional morality at the present time as to what Congress is to do when it does come down to the issues of the distribution of powers between state and national government, or how far the national government ought to go in intrusion upon state, what seemingly was at one time state authority. And it's here, it seems to me, that the principle of subsidiarity is of great use to us. And as I say, this, the principle, I guess we haven't really articulated that today, and social Catholic thought holds, and here I'm reading, fundamental principle of social philosophy, subsidiarity, fixed and unchangeable, that one should not withdraw from individuals and commit to the community what they, individuals, can accomplish by their own enterprise and industry. Seems like a good principle in which to operate. The corollary proposition is that a state ought not to assume functions and responsibilities best fulfilled or performed by subsidiary associations, groups, institutions, public and private within the society. Quite the opposite, the subsidiarity doctrine holds that it is the responsibility of the state to honor and encourage the independence of such associations, groups, and institutions. Now, having said that, let me make just a few rather disjoint observations. One is the only real restraint against the continued concentration of power at the national level will be the acceptance of a constitutional morality that is accepted by the people, by a majority of the people, that contains within it principles of restraint. Now, it seems to me that the subsidiarity principle does do this. And I would say, rather than talk of the 10th Amendment or anything like this, I would say, in place of the 10th Amendment, begin to talk, it's a modest proposal here, begin to talk in terms of the principle of subsidiarity. We see that the national government has moved into certain areas, and if we think now how subsidiarity might help us, I think there are evidences here to indicate that it would have a very beneficial effect. We find that the national government, to put this more concretely, has in recent decades seen fit to move more aggressively against private associations, part of their liberal agenda. For instance, universities, as Robert Nisbet pointed out not too many years ago, were once fiercely independent, but now we know that the universities of the country, from admissions to athletics, really fall under the control of the national government. The subsidiarity principle would never, ever have allowed for this kind of condition to exist. Indeed, when we talk of the Gun-Free School Zone Act, whatever that was, the act that was involved with in the Lopez case, I think we can see here that if the principle of subsidiarity had come into play in the deliberations, such an act probably would never have been passed by Congress in the first place. And when we think, for example, the Violence Against Women Act, there's another one that's been up recently, probably if the subsidiarity principle had come into play, we recognize, no, this isn't the kind of thing that the national government should be doing. So now, let me conclude, having said that and suggesting that this is a possible strategy here, let me just say that I have no great hopes that anything will come of this, in part because one of our difficulties, as I indicated at the end of my paper, is the financial aspect of it. The national government has a monopoly on money. And so even if we were to try to follow subsidiarity principle, well, the states might find themselves, or localities find themselves, without the resources to perform the functions that they are best capable of performing. And then still one other matter, it's very important to me at least, I don't know that Congress is the greatest threat here. I don't know that it has been the one that has led to the greatest concentration, at least with regard to matters that matter most to Americans, I would say that the court, the Supreme Court of the United States, has done more to centralize this country, really, than Congress on matters that hit home with most people: education, religion, moral character, criminal justice, matters like this. I didn't get around to addressing that, but that's another can of worms, and maybe one of these days down the line we can talk about that again. Thank you.